You can take your Bibles, open them this morning to the fifth chapter of the Gospel of Mark. Second book of the New Testament, Mark's Gospel, chapter 5. And as you turn there, find your place in Mark 5. I want to ask you a couple questions to think about. Two related questions. One is about books or movies, depending on if you're a reader or a watcher. And the other is about your own experience. So the first question is this. Whether it's in a movie that you've watched or a book that you've read, I want you to think about one or two of the scariest, most disturbing people or characters that you've ever come across in a movie or a book. And kids, you can think about that too. Maybe you've watched a movie and you've seen someone in a movie that's really, really creepy, right? Okay, who would that be? Perhaps some might think of Frankenstein's monster for a book, or perhaps some kids might think of, my girls might think of Cinderella's stepmother or the White Witch in the Chronicles of Narnia. Okay, the second question is related. But it's about your own experience. The question is simply, have you ever come across a person in real life that you knew was very disturbed? And that perhaps, if you're being honest, just being in the same place as that person really frightened you. In my own life, and Tricia probably remembers this, I can think of one situation when we were in another country where a guy got on a public bus that we were on, speaking in a voice that didn't seem like it could be his own. He was just kind of falling all over the place on the bus. It was probably the one time in my life, my own life, where I really wondered if this man was possessed by a demon. On top of how unsettled I felt about that, being there with my wife, we were also on this bus with a couple of my students at the time. And as this guy stumbled down the aisle of the bus, muttering these disturbing sounds, he eventually took his seat right next to one of my students in the open seat on the bus. And I can remember none of us knowing what to do, me making eye contact with my student and just not really knowing what to do next. Thankfully, everything ended up being okay. But to this day, I remember this so vividly that it can still make me feel uneasy. But this also reminds me of the sadness of every situation like this, where there is such deep brokenness in a human being. Whether from a particular illness or abuse of drugs or the work of Satan or variety of reasons, possibilities, every situation like that is terribly sad. And I know some of you actually work in situations like that on a regular basis. Okay? The reason I bring it up this morning, these questions, is that our text today introduces us to perhaps the most disturbed and the most disturbing person in the Bible. I think you could make a case for that. But we're not just introduced to him. We can tell from how Mark tells the story that Mark wants us to see this guy really clearly so that we will sense just how unstable and troubled the man was. All right, so for example, the story, if you look at Mark 5, that we're going to look at is 20 verses. But if you looked at the same story is actually told in some other places, and it's told like in the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew tells this story in only 6 verses. So Mark tells the same story in 20 verses because Mark really wants you to feel what this guy is like and what it would be like to see him or to hear him, okay? So let's take a look together at Mark chapter 5, verse 1. So the text says, they, that's Jesus and his disciples, came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. Okay, now, last week, we worked through this short story at the end of Mark chapter 4, where Jesus, after a long day of teaching, tells his disciples to get on the boat with him, and they're going to cross over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. First time in the Gospel of Mark that he's crossing into a new region. We don't really know why Jesus decided to cross the sea that night, what his goals were in this other region, how long he planned to stay. The text doesn't tell us any of that. But we watched them last week on the boat. Maybe you remember this if you were here. In the middle of the night, they get caught up in the middle of a terrible, life-threatening storm, which was common on the Sea of Galilee, is to this day. Perhaps you remember what Jesus was doing then. During this terrible storm, where the disciples are like panicked. Some of them are fishermen. They spent their whole life on this sea. They all think they're going to die. They go, they look at Jesus. Jesus is on the back of the boat, sleeping on a cushion. And they go and they finally wake him up. Don't you care that we're going to die? Jesus gets up, rebukes the wind and the sea, two words, and he stills the raging sea. But it's important to remember how that story ends. It's in the as you go through the rest of that story, Jesus then goes to his disciples and he rebukes them. And he says, "Why were you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" Then one of the most interesting things is the last verse of Mark chapter 4. It says, "And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" You see, the interesting thing is the storm's gone at that point. The sea is completely calm. They are completely safe, it would seem. And yet, they are terrified. Why? They're looking at each other saying, who then is this guy in the boat with us, if even the wind and the sea listen to him? Now, that what we just read in Mark 5, verse 1, picks right up from there. After the night out on the sea, they probably arrived in the morning on the other side of the Sea of Galilee, in the region of the Gerasenes, perhaps specifically the town of Gergesa, which I showed on a map last week. We can only imagine how they're feeling when they get to the other side. I mean, they're probably all dead tired for one thing, including Jesus, after the events of the last day and then the last night on the sea. Perhaps they're hoping for a little bit of rest when they get to this side of the sea. I mean, people don't know them very well. They probably don't know as much about Jesus, because you remember, their lives are crazy on the other side of the sea. Wherever they go, there's always crowds. They can never get away from the crowds. They're struggling to find time to eat, but at least maybe on this side, they'll be able to get some rest. Especially since this isn't even a Jewish area. The people on this side of the sea are mostly Gentiles, like most of us here today, not Jewish people. But notice what Mark says. When Jesus stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. Jesus has been in that boat for I don't know how many hours, because he taught all day from the boat, took the trip through the night on the boat, steps foot on land, on the other side of the sea. Immediately, a guy with an unclean spirit comes and meets him. But this isn't just any man, because Mark tells us, where did he come from? He came from the tombs. Now, what do you think about that? He came from out of the tombs. I think we should probably think at least two things. One, we probably don't think about, because we're not coming from a Jewish background. One that we probably don't think about is how Jewish people might think about this, because Jesus and all the disciples are Jewish, okay? A guy coming out of the tombs is totally unclean. You're not even allowed to be around dead bodies in Jewish teaching without becoming unclean. This guy actually lives out in the tombs. And then Mark describes the man specifically as a man who has an unclean spirit. Mark's trying to help you see it. This guy is completely unclean. coming out of the tombs here. The other thing that we probably all think about when we hear of a guy who's coming out of the tombs is that guy is really disturbed. People do not live in the among the tombs, okay? That would unsettle us by itself. Just to get off of a boat and have a guy running at you from out of the tombs. But that is not the end of the description. That's just the beginning of the description. Mark's going to take 64 words to describe this guy. Okay, look at what he says. Verse 3. This guy lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him or to tame him, another translation says. I mean, how do you feel now about the guy? You can tell several things from the description. One is that everybody living in this region, on this side of the sea, would have known about this guy. They had often tried to bind this man with shackles and chains, but it was impossible now. No one could bind him anymore, the text says, not even with a chain. This guy, under the power of Satan, had physical strength beyond anything they had ever experienced. Mark says no one had the strength to subdue him. But it gets even worse because Mark's not done with the description. Look at verse 5. Mark 5:5. Night and day, among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out, screaming out. Other translation says howling, you know, because it might be like Mark's describing him almost like an animal. Screaming out and cutting himself with stones. Can you imagine living in the region? Like, you might consider moving just because of this. Can you imagine having kids and living in this region? Night and day, this guy is constantly screaming, howling. You go to bed on a quiet night. You go to close your door to your house, and you can hear him from a distance screaming. Or as you're out with your children during the day, perhaps walking to a nearby town, you get near the mountain on your way. And what if your child catches sight of this man? What if your child not only hears him screaming, but sees him, how he's got blood all over him because he's been cutting himself through the night before? And they say, Mom, Dad, what's that? What would you say? What would you do about this situation? What could you do? Everything's already been done. There's nothing the people there can do about it. So do you feel what Mark's wanting us to feel? The Bible rarely gives physical descriptions of anybody. We spend all kinds of time thinking about our physical appearance and whatnot. The Bible rarely even talks at all about physical descriptions of people. And so anytime you find a physical description of somebody in the Bible, I say almost every time it's very important to the story. But this description is beyond just about any other in the whole Bible. This might be the longest description of anyone in the scriptures because Mark wants you to see the guy, hear the guy, feel what people in the region feel, and then put yourself with Jesus and the disciples who, as soon as they get off the boat, Jesus steps foot and that guy comes running at you. Maybe he's all bloody. Maybe you can hear him screaming, but he comes running at Jesus. Now, verse 6. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. This goes back to that scene of Jesus stepping off the boat. He gets close to Jesus, and he just falls down on his face before Jesus. Verse 7. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" Doesn't know Jesus, right? This guy, Jesus has never even been over here. "I adjure you by God, do not torment me." If that sounds familiar to you, this is very similar, even in the wording, to what happened in the first chapter of Mark. The first time Jesus entered a Jewish synagogue, there meets him a man with an unclean spirit. And he says something similar. Now, this is the first time Jesus enters Gentile territory. And as soon as he does, a demon-possessed man falls before him, crying out, "What do you have to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Please, I adjure you by God, don't torment me." Or as the NIV says, "In God's name, don't torture me." Now, as a side note, did you hear what the demon-possessed man called Jesus? I've been mentioning this throughout the study of Mark, but did you see it? Okay. The human characters in Mark are always trying to figure out the big question of Mark. Who is Jesus? No human character so far has quite been able to figure it out. But you could even go back to Jesus' own disciples. I mean, that was the question at the end of the last chapter. They're looking at each other, "Who is this?" They've been with him. They left everything for him. They're like, "Who is this?" But here's the thing. Demons in Mark never have any doubt about who Jesus is. They know exactly who he is. He's the Son of the Most High God. And you also see here that even though the demons who are in control of this man have incredible power, power that cannot be tamed by any human being, any mere human being, when they're in the presence of Jesus, they are begging. They become beggars in his presence. "Don't torture me." Then Mark tells us a little more, verse 8. "For Jesus was saying to him, 'Come out of the man, you unclean spirit.' And Jesus asked him, 'What's your name?' And he replied, 'My name is Legion, for we are many.'" Now, the name Legion would have been understood by the readers here, not understood by us probably. The word Legion referred to a military unit in the Roman military, a unit that would have had up to 6,000 soldiers in it, 3,000 to 6,000 soldiers. That's what a legion was. And they would have all known that. So in other words, the man is not possessed by just one demon. I mean, that's what he's saying. Satan has total control over this man. He is possessed by many, many demons. That's why I say the name is Legion, because we are many. But when Jesus shows up, the demons can only beg for mercy. Verse 10, "And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now, there was a great herd of pigs that was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged Jesus, saying, 'Send us to the pigs. Let us enter them.' So Jesus gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea." That is astonishing, okay? In this Gentile area, there are lots of pigs. Roman people, like American people, many American people, like to eat pig, okay? It was Jewish people, this was totally unclean. This is also kind of contributing to this whole unclean idea. Jewish people to this day, pigs, really unclean. But the Roman people, they like to eat pigs. So you got this region, there are a couple thousand pigs that they're raising there, okay? The demons, who seemed so powerful a few minutes ago, are begging Jesus, let us go into the pigs rather than out of the territory. Now, there are things we probably want to know that we just don't get answers to here. Like, why are the demons so desperate to stay in this area? Why pigs? Why would they want to go there? Why then, after they go there, do they want to destroy all the pigs in the sea? I mean, okay? But remember this. The storyteller never has to tell you all the details of the story. The storyteller always gets to choose how many details to tell you. And so you just have to be okay with that. That's the way stories are. You tell stories, you do the same thing. But what Mark does, what he does say is that about 2,000 pigs drowned in the sea that day. As you can imagine, that would have been unlike anything you have ever seen or anyone had ever seen in their entire lives. It would have been devastating financially. 2,000 pigs washing up on the seashore. What to see them, their bodies laying on the sea. Okay. Now think of this. What would you have thought if you were one of the many people out there taking care of all those pigs that day? Because those pigs, they don't just stay there. There's a whole bunch of people out there who are taking care of the pigs, probably for some owner. You know, what are you going to tell the owner? You know, what happened to all my pigs? I don't know. They just all ran down the cliff. I mean, this is amazing kind of stuff. So what do all the herdsmen say? What did all them do? Look at verse 14. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country. And you can imagine that. Go, they tell everybody. And then what do the people do who hear it? They come because they got to see it. I mean, does that really happen? The people come to see what it was that had happened. Verse 15. And they came to Jesus, and what did they see? And they saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed, and in his right mind. And how do they feel? And they were afraid. They see the crazy man sitting there next to Jesus, and he's okay. Freed from the chains of Satan. And how do they feel? They feel afraid. Why? I think that sounds really similar to the disciples the night before on the sea. When the storm was raging, they were afraid. But after the storm was calm and everything seemed to be safe, they were terrified. In this story, of course, everyone was afraid of this man who had been out in their hills, mountains, for who knows how long, maybe a couple of years, we have no idea. Of course they would have been afraid of that man, but now that they come and they see him sitting at the feet of Jesus, and they see Jesus with him, and the guy's completely fine, they feel afraid. Why? It's not entirely clear. I could suggest something like this, that it's one thing to have a crazy man with supernatural strength terrorizing your region night and day, but it's another thing to stand in the presence of a Jewish man who in one day with just a couple of words could change that crazy man. They are afraid. And so those who saw what had happened speak up. See, they probably already told the story, but now that everybody's out there, they tell the story again because now people are like going to listen to them. So verse 16 says, those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. The question is, what are the people going to do? Verse 17, and they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. So just a few verses earlier, the demons were begging Jesus. Now the people of the town are begging Jesus as well. But to do what? They're begging Jesus to leave. Why? Isn't that the question that we would have? Why would you want Jesus to leave? I mean, is it because they're so upset about the pigs and the money that they've lost? Maybe. Do they not care about this poor man who was basically brought out of the land of the dead back into the land of the living? Do they not care about him? Is it because they're so afraid of who Jesus is? If he has the power to do with a couple of words what the whole town couldn't do with shackles and chains? We're just not told exactly why they do it, but here they are begging Jesus, please leave right now. We don't want you here. And so Jesus does what they ask, and he gets ready to leave. But the story isn't over yet, because one more time, someone's going to beg for something from Jesus. Verse 18. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. See, the townspeople begged Jesus to get away from them, but the restored man begs Jesus, let me stay with you. Jesus had saved his life. All he wants now is to be with Jesus. And so he begs Jesus for this. Verse 19. And Jesus did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. Jesus tells him, you can't come with me now, but I have a mission for you. Go home and tell everybody who knows you how good the Lord has been to you. And remember, if you've been paying attention to Mark, Jesus never says this before this to people. He's always telling them or telling demons, be quiet, don't say anything about me. But he looks at this guy and he says, I want you to go home and I want you to tell everybody how good the Lord's been to you. In verse 20, and he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis, that's like the 10 cities around this region, how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. The man obeys, goes throughout the region to all these Gentile cities that Jesus hasn't been to, and he proclaims how much Jesus has done for him. And it's interesting how it's stated, because if you pay attention carefully to that, Jesus told him, go tell everybody what the Lord has done for you. The man goes and tells everybody what Jesus has done for him. Perhaps there's a hint that this man has realized to some degree what none of even the disciples have got their minds around yet. That Jesus is Lord. Wherever this man goes, the people marvel at what they hear. This has got to be one of my favorite stories in the Bible. But what do we do with it? What are we supposed to learn from it? I want us to think about a couple of things. First, I want us to think about Jesus in the story a little more. What do we see about Jesus? Jesus is Lord, even over Satan's forces. If there was ever a man that Satan possessed, it was this man. But Jesus came and plundered Satan's house and rescued that man. And as we saw in Jesus' presence, demons become beggars. But it's not just that we see about Jesus. Think of this, why did Jesus come here? Why did he cross the sea after teaching all day? What was in it for Jesus? I mean, we look at this and we say, what did he get out of this? One crazy man became a follower of him? I mean, that's all he gets. One crazy man who becomes a follower of him. But Jesus came to serve that man, to save that one man. That's all he does on this side of the sea. That's it. He saves that one man so that that man could know him and love him and tell everybody else about him. That's a picture of the mission of Jesus, who came to seek and to save the lost. I was thinking this week as well, it's just interesting observation to make when you look at this guy who is connected closely with the tombs. If you read the whole Gospel of Mark, you pretty much don't hear about tombs other than here And you know where else? 6 times you hear it. I thought it was interesting, just as a meditation of my own. I'm not saying this story is directly about this. But here's this guy living among the dead. Tombs, 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 Mark tells us 3 times in the description of the man. You know the other time in Mark's gospel where you hear 6 times about the tombs? It's only with Jesus. You know, it's with Jesus. John the Baptist ends up in a tomb after he's beheaded for following Jesus, but it's Jesus 6 times at the end of the Gospel of Mark. Jesus goes to the tombs. And as you start to like look, you step back and you think, how is it that this man's brought out from the dead back into the land of the living? And here's this guy, his flesh is torn, living among the tombs, and you know, that guy only made it out of there because of Jesus and because of what ultimately Jesus would do when he would give up his own body to be torn and he would be taken to the tombs. And because one day Jesus would rise out of the tomb and he would come back to life. He would return to the land of the living. And you see, that's really, if you put Mark all together, that's how this guy makes it out. It's because of Jesus. Jesus' mercy. And it's ultimately because of what Jesus would do in being willing to go to the tomb. And how he could rise and have victory over death. When we think about Jesus in the story, but we think about the man in the story. This man was as bad off as a person has ever been. And one of the things I want you to think about with the man is what could he do about it? And what hope really was there for that guy? We don't even know his name. What hope did he have? The only hope that guy had was if Jesus came to seek him out and to save him. And that's exactly what Jesus did for him. And so then what do you think the man felt for Jesus now? This man, whose name we don't even know, loved Jesus and wanted nothing more than to be with Jesus. But when Jesus told him, "You can't be with me now, but this is what I want you to do," the man obeyed and went everywhere telling people how much Jesus had done for him. And I read that psalm earlier today, Psalm 116, that opening line. I love the Lord. Do you love Jesus? Do you want to be with Jesus? Do you think he's had mercy on you? Singing, has Jesus shown us enough mercy yet that we would want to tell other people about him and how much mercy he's had on us? Has he shown us enough mercy yet so that we would actually want to go and tell friends how much the Lord has done for us? This man who had been rescued from much, he loved much. And then lastly, I want us to think about ourselves in light of the story. Part of why I think our love for Jesus sometimes grows cold, why our heart to tell others about what the Lord has done for us sometimes grows weak, is that I think we sometimes forget who we were or who we would be without Jesus, or perhaps we don't even really believe that we were or that we would be so bad off without Jesus. Like, I've been thinking about the description of this crazy man all week, and I really think that as we read it, Mark wants us to think this guy is terribly disturbed. He's hopeless, helpless, downright frightening. That's what Mark wants us to think. And it's all true. And I'm thankful that for many of us, we probably don't have a background quite like this with this guy, okay? But here's the thing. When we read the Bible, we rarely see physical descriptions of anyone in the Bible. Certainly not like one about this guy. But do you know what kind of detailed descriptions we do see in the Bible? We see them in text after text, descriptions, lengthy descriptions of what we were and what we would be apart from Jesus. And they are downright frightening. And what I wonder is if we really believe them about ourselves. And so what I want us to do is I want to have us close this morning by reading together, and I hope confessing, if you believe these, the truths written in, we're just going to look at three parts of three texts about who we were and about what Jesus has done for us. And then Phil will come and we'll sing the song Grace and Peace as we close our gathering. Would you read these with me if you believe them? And I'll see if this will still work for us. So I want to read this together. So one's going to be from Romans, one from Titus, and one from Ephesians. Confess this if you believe this. Okay. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. This one from Titus. At one time, we too were foolish, disobedient, deceived, and enslaved by all kinds of passions and pleasures. We lived in malice and envy, being hated and hating one another. But when the kindness and love of God, our Savior, appeared, he saved us, not because of righteous things we had done, but because of his mercy. And one more from Ephesians. As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins, but because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ, even when we were dead in transgressions. For it is by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not from yourselves. It is the gift of God.